Okay, so welcome to the Sutta class for today. And now, just looking around, some of you were... my name is Mate Sujato, for those of you who don't know me. And now, some of you were here yesterday for the early Buddhism course, right? Is there anyone who wasn't here for the early Buddhism course? Few people weren't here, okay. So that's fine. I just wanted to... I was thinking about what to talk about today. I thought, well, why don't we, because for the early Buddhism course we had a number of suttas which were assigned as the background reading, but because we covered a lot of material there, we didn't get to talk about those suttas in a whole lot of detail, so I thought it might be a good idea to have a look at one of those suttas in a bit more detail today, so we got a bit more time to spend with that particular one. So I thought we'd look at the Nalanda Sutta, from the Sanyutta Nikaya, because for a number of reasons, it's a lovely, interesting little sutta, and also because if any of you were at the last sutta class that I gave here, I gave a class on two verses, eight lines, and we didn't manage to finish it off. So I thought, well, we'd better not choose a long one, otherwise we'll be in big trouble. Okay, now. You have the printout here, thanks to the wonderful people at BSWA. This printout, incidentally, for those of you who are not familiar, this printout is done from the Sutta Discovery Series by Pia Tun. And Pia Tun's a very good friend of ours from the Buddhist Fellowship, or among other things, he teaches at the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore. And Pia has been doing these sutta classes for many years, and he does a great job of doing detailed notes and references and so on for all of his the sutta classes that he does. And so over the years, he's actually sort of accumulated quite a comprehensive basis of studies and so on. So if you're looking for something that has this kind of material and explanations and so on, that goes into a bit more detail than you'll find from Bhikkhu Bodhi's footnotes, then you can check out Pia Tun's website, and he always puts everything online, so you can get that. And he's also printed the books, so you can probably order them as well. Okay, so 47.12. Aha, that's the first volume. Sorry about that, Lynn. You need the either one volume edition or the volume two of the two volume edition. Yeah, so it's in the second half. So just getting Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation as well. Okay, so when we were choosing the suttas for the early Buddhism course, of course, it's basically a bit random, really, because, you know, there's so many thousands of suttas that we could choose from. So the ones that we end up choosing is obviously a bit arbitrary. But we chose this particular one. What we've been trying to do is choose ones that have a sort of combination of an interesting Dhamma content, as well as having a kind of a relevant, maybe personal or biographical interest, like an event in the life of the Buddha or something like that. And so this particular sutta meets those two requirements. The sutta as it stands is found in the Sanyutta Nikaya, Sanyutta 47.12, and it's also found in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. And that in itself is quite an interesting little detail. Actually, if we look at the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the account of the Buddha's last journey, it's a long discourse and composed of some... thank you very much. Thank you. No, I need either volume 2 or volume 1, if there's a one volume, or if there's one volume edition. Thank you. Anyway, that one is fine. Thank you so much. Okay. I'll just find the page of this before going on. Okay. So in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, we find a lengthy narrative which gives the story of the Buddha's last journey, his in the few months before he passed away. Much of that story is unique to the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, right? But within that, there are many shorter episodes, and many of those shorter episodes are found elsewhere in the Pali Canon as well. Not only are they found elsewhere in the Pali Canon, but they're also found very frequently in the corresponding and parallel suttas in the Chinese Agamas and elsewhere. So this particular sutta, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, it seems was one of the most popular suttas in the whole Buddhist tradition. Okay, there's many versions of it. We find in Chinese, probably half a dozen different versions in Chinese, and Tibetan, and many of the Sanskrit fragments and so on that we have also from this sutta. So it's obviously very popular in the Buddhist tradition, and for good reason. It tells a very moving story. There's a lot of human interest to it. It's one of the most, of all of the early suttas, it's one of the most, I guess, one of the ones that really kind of draws you in as a narrative and as something that you read for the love of it, as well as for the teachings in there. Now, as part of that narrative of that overall story of the passing away of the Buddha, within that narrative, we find echoes of that theme, the same theme. Okay, so the theme of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the great theme of it, of course, is impermanence. Yeah, it's the Buddha is going to die, and it's how do we face up to impermanence? How do we deal with the fact that the teacher who we love so much is just going to die? Yeah, and so that theme is addressed and dealt with in various ways throughout the sutta, and it's echoed in various other ways. And one of the echoes of that great theme is the same event happening in the life of Sariputta. This particular discourse is the event that records the time when the Buddha met very venerable Sariputta for the last time. Sariputta was one of the earliest disciples of the Buddha. The story of him meeting the Buddha is found in the account of the events following the Buddha's awakening, which is found in the Vinaya. And if you remember, those of you who were at the early Buddhism class yesterday, in the very first slide, we had the Ye Dhamma Hetu Pabhava, those Dhammas that arise from a cause. So that was a conversation, that was the conversion of Sariputta. Yeah? So that whole narrative from the Buddha's enlightenment to the Buddha's death, yeah, the Venerable Sariputta's story is quite literally contained within that great story of the Buddha. Yeah, it's as a disciple, it's following the same path in a slightly different way to that of the Buddha. One of the curious details is that in the Sanghutta Nikaya, where we find the Nalanda Sutta, we also find an account where Ananda brings after Sariputta dies, Ananda brings the bowl and robes of Sariputta to the Buddha. Yeah? The funny thing is that particular detail is not found in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. I find this very curious. I don't know why that is. I've tried to think of a reason why, but I can't, because it would seem, you know, all too, you know, it must have happened shortly after the Nalanda Sutta, right? And Sariputta obviously died shortly after that, and yet for some reason that's not mentioned in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. I find that kind of odd. I don't really know why it is. Anyway, so what we do have is this one where Sariputta meets the Buddha. So let's get straight onto the sutta. I'll read the sutta in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, and we will then look in some more detail at Pierre Tan's analysis. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Nalanda in Pavarika's mango grove. So if you remember the, those of you who have been to India, or if you remember the maps that we looked at India yesterday, you know where Nalanda is slightly north of Rajagaha. So on the road north from Rajagaha towards Patna is Nalanda. At the beginning of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Buddha is in Rajagaha, and he leaves that place and heads north and ends up in the Vajjayan Republic, north of the river Ganges. So Nalanda is not far north from Rajagaha. I'm not sure how far it is. I think less than 100 kilometres, yeah? Probably 1 or 2 days' walk north of Nalanda, of Rajagaha. And the Venerable Sariputta approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side and said to him, "Venerable Sir, I have such confidence in the Blessed One that I believe there is not now, there has not been nor ever will be, nor exists at present, another ascetic nor Brahman more knowledgeable than the Blessed One with respect to enlightenment." And Buddha replies, "Lofty indeed is this bellowing utterance of yours, Sariputta. You have roared a definitive, categorical lion's roar. Have you now, Sariputta, encompassed with your mind the minds of all the arahants, the perfectly enlightened ones, arisen in the past, and known thus? Those blessed ones were of such virtue, or such qualities, or such wisdom, or such dwellings, or of such liberation." "No, Bhante," he said. "Then, Sariputta, have you encompassed with your mind the minds of all the arahants who will arise in the future?" He says, "No, Bhante." "Then, Sariputta, have you encompassed with your mind my own mind, and known thus, the Blessed One is of such virtue, or such qualities, or such wisdom, or such dwellings, or of such liberation?" "No, Bhante." And the Buddha says, "Sariputta, when you don't have any knowledge of the minds of any Buddhas of the past, present, and future, why do you utter this lofty, bellowing utterance and roar, this definitive, categorical lion's roar?" It, of course, it doesn't mean that he actually was roaring like a lion. It's a metaphor. Okay. And it's completely beside the point, but I remember the monks on my side, Venerable Nandiya. Some of you may remember another very tall, skinny monk called Nandiya who was in Bodhinyana many years ago when I was first in Bodhinyana, the late 90s, and a German monk. And when he came to Perth for the first time from Germany, when he was still a layman, he came and stayed at a friend's flat. Arrived at night time and he was sleeping like in the front room of the friend's flat, and the window was open. And he was lying there trying to get to sleep, and he heard this elephants trumpeting, and there's lions roaring, and all of these kind of beasts. And he's thinking, "My God, what kind of country is this?" Turns out he was on Mounts Bay Road. He's like over the back from the zoo. So, anyway. Okay. So, where was I? Okay, so this is not, that's not the kind of roar when Buddha said lions roar here. Okay. And so Sariputta admits, "I do not have any knowledge of the minds of the Buddhas of the past, present, and future, but still I have understood by inference from the Dhamma." Okay, so that's an interesting term, Dhammanvaya, the inference from the Dhamma. What does Pierre Tan translates it, the drift of the Dhamma, which is not a very good translation. I don't know why people translate it like that way. It means inference. "Suppose, Venerable Sir, a king had a frontier city with strong ramparts, walls, and arches, and with a single gate. The gatekeeper posted there would be wise, competent, and intelligent. One who keeps out strangers and admits acquaintances, while he's walking along the path that encircles the city, he could not see a cleft or an opening in the walls, even big enough for a cat to slip through. He might think, whatever large creatures enter or leave this city, all enter and leave through this one gate. So too, Venerable Sir, I have understood this by inference from the Dhamma. Whatever Buddhas of the past, present and future, all of those blessed ones had first abandoned the five hindrances, the corruptions of the mind and the weakeners of wisdom. And then, with their minds well established in the four establishments of mindfulness, they had developed correctly the seven factors of enlightenment, and thereby they had awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment. And the same is true of all the Buddhas of the past, the present, the future and the present. And the Buddha responded, "Good, good, sadhu, sadhu, Sariputta. Therefore, Sariputta, you should repeat this Dhamma exposition frequently to the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis, to the male lay followers and the female lay followers. Even though some foolish people may have perplexity or uncertainty regarding the Tathagata, when they hear this Dhamma exposition, their perplexity or uncertainty regarding the Tathagata will be abandoned." So there's a number of interesting details here, which I'll go on. So if the story of the Sariputta's passing away is in fact the very next sutta in the Satipatthana Samyutta, and you can read it there, and again, not for some reason in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta itself. Okay, let's see what Pia has as his notes for this particular sutta, and he usually gives some good background. So the sutta is found almost the same in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta and also in the Sampasadaniya Sutta, Digha 28, with a much longer account by Sariputta of the Buddha's virtue, which concludes in the same way. Now, Sampasadaniya Sutta is another interesting sutta, because what's fascinating about Mahaparinibbana Sutta is not just that it's very long, by far the longest discourse, but also that there's actually several other discourses, or at least two other large discourses, which kind of half belong there, which have been removed because that would make it even longer, right? So it's actually an abbreviated version. So this Ananda Sutra, quite a short one, is found there, but the Sampasadaniya Sutta, which is an extended version of the same thing, has been removed. Presumably, it maybe broke up the narrative flow too much to be included. And a similar thing happened with another sutta called the Mahasudassana Sutta, also another sutta all by itself in the Digha Nikaya, but in some versions of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta is found in full in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta itself. So this is where you see the decisions of the editors and the redactors of the canon, who had a certain freedom to be able to put certain passages, you know, in brief or in a lengthy form, or to place them in one place or put them in another place according to what they thought the best form was. And that wasn't, redactors in different schools or different traditions didn't always make the same choices. Whether the Sampasadaniya Sutta should, with the extended account, should be regarded as authentic, or whether it should be regarded as a sort of later extension of the original core, which is what we find in the Nalanda Sutta, I'm not sure. I haven't studied that in detail, so I couldn't say. This is Sariputta's last meeting with the Buddha, knowing he'll die in 7 days' time. This is according to the commentary. He takes leave of the Buddha and visits his mother and predeceases the Buddha on the full moon day of Kartika in October and November. So that's all the background according to the commentarial story. How much historical basis there is in that, I'm not sure. Moggallana, his closest friend and the Buddha's left-hand monk, passes away a fortnight later on the new moon day. And again, it does seem that Sariputta and Moggallana did die shortly before the Buddha did, but whether all the details of those accounts are correct, we're not really sure. Both Sariputta and Moggallana were older than the Buddha, according to the commentaries. Now, at the end of the discourse, Sariputta makes a very important statement regarding the training leading to awakening, that Buddhas of the past, present and future all become awakened after abandoning the five hindrances, developing, being established on the four Satipatthanas and developing the seven Bodhisattvas. I'll come back to that group in a little while. Bhikkhu Bodhi notes a chronological problem in the account related in the Chunda Sutta, which is the next sutta in the Satipatthana Sanyutta. In the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, Sariputta's lion's roar, as mentioned in the Nalanda Sutta, takes place during what appears to be the Buddha's final journey on the route from Rajagaha to Vaisali. From Vaisali, the Buddha heads for Kusinara without returning to Savatthi, which is about 200 kilometres to the west, and Savatthi is a long way out of the road. Yet the present sutta shows the Buddha residing at Savatthi when he receives the news of Sariputta's death. That's the Chunda Sutta. To preserve the traditional chronology, the commentaries have the Buddha make an additional side trip to Savatthi following his rains retreat at Belavagamaka, an excursion not mentioned in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Sariputta, according to the commentary, accompanies him on this trip to Savatthi, later takes his leave and returns to his native village of Nalakagama, where he falls ill and dies. That commentarial explanation is highly implausible, and the Bhikkhu Bodhi really should note that. It's basically impossible. I mean, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta is quite thorough about documenting every step along the Buddha's way, and every journey from one little village to another is documented. And the idea that somehow he would go from this little village to that little village and that little village and that little village and that little village, and everyone would be documented, and then all of a sudden he goes 200 kilometres to the west for an important crucial event in the life of the Sangha and then back again without any mention, is just not really plausible at all. Far more likely that there's simply a mistake in the setting for the Chunda Sutta, and it really should be set probably in Belavagama or somewhere similar in Vaisali, near Vaisali. And the setting at Savatthi was put in by accident, just as a sort of automatic standardization thing. You know, when you're making documents or sometimes on the computer and you copy and paste stuff, and sometimes you don't always change the bit that you're supposed to have changed when you copy it and paste. So you find those kinds of mistakes in the suttas sometimes as well. So and nobody kind of noted the mistake. All right. So that's the general survey of the Nalanda Sutta. And let's just go back and have a look at a few more of these details a little bit more closely. Now, why do you think that Sariputta made this kind of statement? Right? Interesting question. The sutta doesn't really discuss that. Why do you think it is? Why would he come along to the Buddha and say to the Buddha that you're more enlightened than anybody else, or no one's more enlightened than you? Yeah? Anyone got any ideas? Out of great faith, yeah? The name of the extended version of this sutta, which I referred to earlier, is actually called the Sampasadaniya Sutta, the Sutta of Great Faith, you could translate that. Yeah? So perhaps that was the case. Perhaps just a simple, if he knew that his death was going to be soon, just wanted to come and express this. Yeah, so that might be the case. Yeah? Any other thoughts? Affection, yeah? Can an arahant have affection? Of course they can. They can have that loving affection, but he's just not going to be sad, yeah? It's very interesting in the sutta where the Buddha is remarking on the death of Sariputta and Moggallana, yeah? And he says, he looks around the Sangha and says, the Sangha seems to be empty now that Sariputta and Moggallana have gone. And, I mean, he doesn't actually say that, but it's kind of the closest that you get, I think, in the suttas, almost the closest. You get a few of these little remarks around that time that seem almost a little bit melancholic or a little bit wistful or something like that, you know. I'd be going too far to say that the Buddha was depressed because Sariputta and Moggallana died. But, you know, this is kind of interesting, you know, just to say, oh, the Sangha seems empty now, yeah. It's a bit similar to when he was walking on that final journey and he's just kind of Sometimes, you know, he's looking back at all these places that they're visiting and knowing that he's visiting them for the last time. Yeah, and so this is almost this kind of quite sweet sense of almost melancholy or something like that. It might be even melancholy might be overstating it. So any other thoughts? Why is it that Sariputta would come and make this kind of statement? And gratitude, He's what, sir? He's stating a truth, yes. But why that particular truth at that particular time? There's lots of truths, lots of ways of putting things. This way is quite unusual. Yeah? If you see like a lot of the conversations between, you know, someone with such great wisdom like Sariputta and the Buddha, you know, usually the conversations are quite abstract, you know, they'll start out at quite a quite a high level of Dhamma. You know, so for example, in the Nidana Sanyutta, you have one where the Buddha says, I think he says, "Idang Bhutang, this has come to be," right? And then Sariputta has to interpret this and give an explanation. What does it mean when he says this has come to be? Or even in the Satchavibhanga Sutta, which we looked at yesterday in the early Buddhism course, where again the Buddha sort of mentions the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta and the Four Noble Truths, and leaves it for Sariputta to explain it in detail. So again, in that case, you have much more of an abstract thing. In this one, he's making a very personal statement about the Buddha. A bit like a goodbye here. Yeah. Okay. Lion's roar, generally lion's roar means a statement of like a very bold statement of great confidence. Something like that, yeah. Usually it's about some kind of spiritual claim. Yes, yeah, in northern India there were lions. I think there still are lions in the Gujarat, or Rajasthan or somewhere in the deserts. Yes. Sorry? There were. Are they still? Do they still have? Yeah. They still have? Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yes. Yeah. One of the simile that the Buddha gives when he's talking about how what happens when lions roar, he says all of the other animals shake and quiver in fear when the lion gives his roar, and even the elephants who are tied up in the village will break their bonds Well, literally, they'll crap themselves where they are, and they're so terrified at the at that. Yeah. So, go on. That's an interesting point. Yeah. That's putting it into the more specifically in the context of the Buddha's passing away. That's of course a great concern, is the succession. Obviously, Sariputta and Moggallana would have been the natural successors to the Buddha, and if they're aware that they're going to pass away soon, as it's quite, you know, common, especially people who are very spiritually advanced, to know that they're going to die soon. So if they knew that, then definitely there would be concerns about the succession, and that's, you know, already stated before when in the story of Devadatta, that the Buddha said, you know, I wouldn't give the Sangha even to Sariputta and Moggallana, much less to a piece of spit like you, as the line says. So poor old Devadatta isn't going to get control of the Sangha, And so Putra Moggallana aren't, yeah? So who is? Yeah? And it's an interesting question then, because, you know, the next probably in line of seniority, of course, is Mahakasapa, and he did, it seems, take control of the Sangha, but it's not really his style, right? I mean, he sort of rose to the challenge after the Buddha passed away, but, you know, he was much more of a recluse who lived in the forest and didn't really get involved much in the whole teaching and organization of the Sangha and everything. So, you know, it was quite a serious issue. So I think that's part of it. But always when we're looking for interpretation or understanding of the suttas and particular details like that, always the first thing we should try to do is look within the text itself. And because often when we read things, we're very apt to read our own emotional responses into it. We might think from our point of view, we would feel like that. And so we're going to infer that then Sariputra and so would feel the same way. But rather than doing that, as much as we can, let's read the actual text first and see what that says. One of the other interesting things about this little text is the Buddha's response at the end, which is also a bit kind of unusual. Yeah? He says, good, good, Sariputta. He says, therefore, Sariputta, you should repeat this Dhamma exposition frequently to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, male and female lay followers. Now, I'm slightly curious, given that Sariputta is going to be dying very shortly, right? How frequently can he teach that? Anyway, he then, even though some foolish people may have perplexity or uncertainty regarding the Tathagata, when they hear this Dhamma exposition, their perplexity or uncertainty will be abandoned. So it's a bit of a kind of pointed remark, isn't it? Yeah, some foolish people. Who's he thinking of, right? We don't exactly know, but perhaps this is the point. Perhaps there has been some criticism. Perhaps there's been some questioning or some rumble somewhere. And Sariputta was coming and publicly reaffirming his faith in the Buddha in the face of these rumours. I'll come to your question in just a second, but one of the things with this whole narrative, I mentioned before that this is like a rounding off narrative. So we have the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is the Buddha's death, and the Mahaparinibbana Sutta in many ways echoes the story of the Buddha's awakening and the time after the Buddha's awakening. Okay, and there are many, many aspects and elements of these two narratives which we find echoed from one to the other. Many, many of them. Okay, one of them being the involvement of Sariputta. And in that, the Buddha's awakening narrative, we find the Buddha first meets Sariputta, says that he'll be his greatest disciple, and then he gives him the going forth. Okay. But also another detail that you find in that story of the Buddha's awakening is a similar kind of question with regard to the authority and ability, the sort of the depth and the profundity of the Buddha's awakening. And in that case, it's particularly questioned in relation to the fire-worshipping ascetics who the Buddha had converted. And because the leader of that fire-worshipping ascetics was a certain Kassapa, right? Not the same Kassapa as Mahakassapa, another Kassapa. And he was a well-known teacher at the time. And the question was, you know, is the Buddha a student of this Kassapa or is Kassapa a student of the Buddha? Okay? So, and so Kassapa came and bowed to the Buddha and said, no, the Buddha is my teacher and I am the student. So again, we find a similar kind of motif that there's like a questioning of the status of the Buddha, who is really the awakened one, the teacher. And so it would be very much in agreement with the tendency of these two narratives to echo similar themes, yeah, that you find in the both places. So I suspect that perhaps this is underlying point. And remember that to us, it seems a little bit, it's almost a bit absurd to say, you know, is there anyone more enlightened than the Buddha, right? I mean, we're so used to the idea, we've had Buddha images on our shrines, and this idea that the Buddha is the great awakened being is part of our whole culture for such a long time. It's just so obvious. But at that time, the Buddha was a man who was a teacher and had followers, yeah? So obviously a very special man, very charismatic and so on, but the idea that perhaps someone might be more enlightened or whatever would not have been an outrageous question to ask at that time. That's right, yes. Absolutely, yes. Yes. Absolutely. And you know, when you find that there is that kind of power vacuum when somebody dies. So there were those, you know, people in the Sangha at the time when the Buddha died who were like, oh, at last, got rid of that old man who kept on making all those rules. Now we can do what we want. So again, from our point of view, it seems completely outrageous, right? But that's the reality of life. Okay, so these are just some kind of speculations, but the main point I wanted to make here is just to, for when you're reading the suttas, you know, when you come up with questions like this, you remember, okay, well, look, you know, we can't make a definitive answer to that question, okay? The sutta itself doesn't say why Sariputta came and made this statement. But when we're reflecting on it, if we raise these questions, the first thing we should do is look for clues and hints within the text itself to see whether there's anything there that might answer the question. And then we try to rely on that rather than relying on our own ideas first off. Okay. Now, the other question here, of course, another point to mention is that this sutta assumes the existence of Buddhas in the past, the present and the future, right? And of course this is something that we meet with repeatedly in the Pali Canon, and we were just noted yesterday, I was doing some bit of research for the early Buddhism course, and more or less by accident I came across a passage from a Tibetan mantra on the Buddhas, and it lists the seven Buddhas of the past, and you can see even the Sanskrit names of those Buddhas are the same as the names of the seven Buddhas of the past as recognized in the Pali tradition. So this is obviously quite an old tradition. The general idea, and here we have to, I think, distinguish between the principle, the general idea of things, and the specific details. The general idea is that the Dhamma is a truth. It's just the way that the world is, right? And that from time to time, people will understand that and will teach that Dhamma, okay? And so that the Buddha, in that sense, is not unique, okay? He's unique in his own historical period, but not unique in a larger sense. And so this is a basic principle, and this is quite different, for example, from how, say, some religious teachers are seen in some religions. So, for example, in Christianity, Jesus is seen as being a unique event in the history of the world. Yeah, so the life and teachings and death of Jesus is something that's unprecedented either before or after in the history of the world. It's like it's a decisive moment. Whereas for Buddhism, it's much more cyclical view of things. Yeah, so Buddhas appear from time to time. They will teach. Their teachings will propagate for a period, and then they'll pass away. Later on, they'll come back again. So I think that that idea, the principle, is very straightforward and quite very healthy, actually. One of the nice aspects, I think, of Buddhism as a religion is that we don't expect that our religion will last forever. We don't expect that somehow we're going to make the whole world Buddhist, right? We have a perception, understanding that, well, Buddhism will be around for a while and it's a precious thing, we should keep it there and last, but eventually it will pass away. And so the perception of the impermanence of Buddhism as a religion, I think, is a very healthy thing. And this is something which also is part of the overall theme of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Yeah? It's not just that the Buddha is dying, but that the Buddhism itself will die and disappear from the world. How do we respond to this? So that, I think, is quite healthy. Now, it does raise the question, however, of to what extent we can consider, who are these Buddhas of the past, right? We have lists of them. We have names, right? We're told, you know, certain details of them and so on. One thing that we do find is that in the suttas that most of the time when the Buddhas of the past and the future are mentioned, it's mentioned like it is in this sutta, in a fairly general sense. They're not given names, they're not tied down to any historical period, we're not told any details about them. It's just a general acknowledgement that there are people awakened in the past and the future. And only in very, very few places do we find more details given, and those places generally seem to be somewhat later in development. Whether we can actually identify any of these Buddhas of the past as being literally historical figures who lived in India, possible. There's been sages in India for a long time. We know from the artwork of the Indus Valley about 2,000 years before the Buddha, it has pictures of people who are sitting in meditation and so on. So certainly conceivable that there were awakened beings, but there's nothing about the stories of those Buddhas of the past that really suggests that they are historical figures in any meaningful sense. I mean, when they're dated, they're put at periods of time which are like millions of years in the past and so on, which is obviously impossible from an evolutionary point of view. So perhaps past world systems or whatever, but certainly not in terms of a historical reality. And this is, in that respect, Buddhism is quite different from Jainism. And in the Jain religion, you have a similar idea of their world leaders, or teachers, who existed in the past. Okay, so that aspect of it's very similar. But the one difference is that the immediate one prior to the contemporary of the Buddha was Mahavira, yeah, and the one immediately prior to him was called Parshvanatha, and he was said to exist about 200 years before the time of Mahavira and the Buddha. Yeah, so it's quite likely that he was actually a historical figure. And then the one before Parshvanatha was said to live like millions of years ago and so on and so forth. So then we're into the realm of legend. So there is that interesting difference. And so most historians interpret that as saying that Jainism was actually founded by Parshvanatha a couple of hundred years before Mahavira. So when we're thinking about this, I think it's important to just acknowledge the difference here between the principle of enlightened beings appearing in the world from time to time and the historical claims about the names and nature and life of those. And those historical claims are only made once or twice in the suttas, and in those places they're in contexts that look like they're later additions. So my feeling is most likely that in the earliest tradition, we only had statements like this one here, that there's kind of general statements of the principle rather than detailed historical information about Buddhas of the past and the future. But that's just a suggestion. Okay, so Sariputta says he can't read the Buddha's mind. He doesn't know through his own direct knowledge what's going on in the Buddha's head. I wonder what would happen if you hooked the Buddha up to an MRI machine. What would happen? Sorry? You might blow the machine up. Yeah? Yeah, it could happen. Yeah. Maybe nothing was happening. Yeah. Yeah. I heard a story when I was in Thailand, one of the monasteries I was staying at, the teacher. According to the story I've heard, the teacher was invited to Mexico. He was teaching in Mexico, and they invited him to the university or something. I think he did some TV program or something. And they put the EEG things on him to see his brain activity. And it's like, they put it on him and the EEG is like this and stuff. And then they said, okay, Ajahn, please, go into meditation. So he went to meditation. It's just like, boom, boom, boom. There's nothing there. And so they were like, oh, hang on, there must be something wrong with the machine. So they get it out and test the connections and everything like that. Okay, we'll do it again, and, you know, put it on somebody else, and it's like this. And then put it on the Ajahn, and it's like, oh, there's nothing there. So maybe that might happen. Yeah. Anyway, so... But he says he can understand through dhammanvaya, an inference of the dhamma. This is very interesting, and this is something which I think is sometimes misunderstood in modern explanations of Buddhism. Often when we're teaching Buddhism today, we emphasize, and quite rightly so, the importance of direct experience. Okay, you have to know it for yourself. You have to know what is the feel if I touch this piece of paper. What does it feel like? Yeah, and so our Dhamma meditation is about getting in touch with our direct experience of things. What do those objects of the senses actually feel like? What is it like to see? What is it like to touch? Yeah? And so we're bringing ourselves back into our senses, bringing ourselves back into the present moment, and grounding our meditation on that. And so this obviously is an extremely important part of Buddhist practice, and especially meditation, and it's quite rightly emphasized because I think it's the most distinctive and important contribution which is characteristic of Buddhism, and which is necessary that Buddhism brings to the table. Okay, so that's great. As always with these things, though, there's sometimes a tendency to take it too far, and sometimes it's not merely that direct experience is important, but that any kind of inference is sometimes deprecated, so that direct experience is all there is, and the only way to know things is through direct, immediate personal experience. Yeah, and so sometimes this kind of teaching is found in some schools of modern Buddhism. It's important to know that that's definitely not what's found in early Buddhism. It's also definitely not what's found in any of the traditional schools of Indian Buddhism. Now, the most characteristic philosophical developments in later Indian Buddhism were developments in the field of what's called epistemology. Right? Epistemology is the philosophy of knowing. How do we know things? Okay, and generally speaking, in Indian epistemology and in Buddhist epistemology also, they acknowledge two main sources of knowledge. One source of knowledge is direct experience. Okay, the technical term is pratyaksha. Okay, and that means, what do you actually hear at that moment of hearing in the present moment? What do you actually touch? Yeah, that direct experience. So with that direct experience, you know that your ear knows sound. Okay, your ear does not know words. Your ear does not know, oh, that's a motorcycle in the distance. It does not know what those things mean. That's all your mind is understanding that. Yeah, your ear just knows sound. Your eye just knows sight. Yeah, it doesn't know that's a roof, that's a floor, that's a person. Okay, that's your mind that knows that. Your eye just knows the light, and so on for the senses. So this is like direct experience. And of course, your mind directly experiences mental objects, thoughts, images, memories, perceptions, and so on. And that's all happening in the present moment. So this is one source of true knowledge. The other source of true knowledge is inference. Okay, and that's called, as in the current sutra, is called anvaya. In the later philosophers usually called it anumana, but had the same meaning. And what that means is, what can we legitimately draw from direct experience? Okay, so this is what inference is what we can draw from direct experience. Very similar to the way that inference or inductive inference is used in science. Okay, so you have the equivalent in science would be that the direct experience is like the data that you generate through doing an experiment, and then the inference is, well, what are the conclusions and the hypotheses and so on that you can draw from that data to explain it the best possible way. Now, the relationship between these two things is quite problematic, and it's never 100%. It's not very easy to pin down exactly. Well, what can we legitimately infer, right? How far can we infer things, right, and still remain within the realm of truth? Yeah. So when I hear a sound, right, this is relatively straightforward. I hear a sound, I know that's a sound, and I can know that with a great deal of certainty. Okay? Now I can infer from that, oh, this is the sound of Bhante Sujato talking. Okay? And I can know that, but I can't know that with quite the same degree of certainty, can I? Because, well, maybe I'm a hologram of Bhante Sujato. Maybe this is just... But we can know that with a pretty good degree of certainty, right? If you're listening to it, say, on an MP3 file over the web, you'd maybe be a little less certain, yeah? If you're listening to it in a very poor quality MP3 file, you might even be quite uncertain. Actually, who's that talking? I'm not quite sure who that is. It sounds like it might be Bhante Sujato, but I'm not quite sure. So this is kind of degrees of certainty with inference as to how sure it is. And of course, this is one of the topics of the epistemologists, is to discuss this and to talk about how what that means in terms of direct knowledge. Now, generally speaking, with Buddhism, the Buddhist philosophers are not concerned with the question of is that knowledge, or can that knowledge be absolutely true? And this is the main concern of the epistemologists in the West. Okay, how do we arrive at an absolutely true form of knowledge? Okay, that's a concern which the Buddhists didn't have, because Buddhism is a functional religion. For the Buddhist philosophers, it doesn't matter so much whether the truth you arrive at is absolute or not. What matters is it effective or not? Does it work? Right? Does it get you liberated? Okay? And it's a pragmatic definition of truth, which is not dissimilar, again, to the shift in Western philosophy from the Greek and the Socratic philosophers, who are trying to arrive at some abstract notion of perfect truth, to what you see currently in science, where they've essentially given up the notion of searching for an absolute truth, and now you have this criteria of falsifiability. You can't prove anything is true, but is it good enough for the time being until somebody proves it wrong? So it's a pragmatic definition of truth. A scientific truth is true enough if it works to do what we want to do with it. Yeah? And then that's true enough in that case. So Buddhism has a similar notion of truth. Truth is whatever is true enough to get us liberated. Yeah? The point is freedom. The point is not the truth. Yeah? So this is the point with Sariputta's argument here, to come back to the sutta, that Sariputta is making an inference. Okay? So he's drawing on his own knowledge, his own understanding of the Dhamma, and he's inferring from that in a way that which is true enough. And so the Buddha is then asking him about that question of the truth. I should add that in the Buddhist traditions, as well as those two forms of knowledge, then the other form of knowledge which is discussed, or which is dealt with, is the question of the reliability of the Buddhist tradition, especially the Buddhist suttas. Yeah, so the voice of an authoritative... Right, and of an authority. Again, very similar in the West, where in modern science, where, you know, how much weight do you give to the findings and ideas of previous experts in the field, right? So the Buddha was the previous expert in the field, so how much weight do you give to him? And is that merely part of inference, or is that another kind of knowing something in and of itself? And these were some of the questions that were discussed by the later philosophers. Okay, so Sariputta draws this inference, yeah, and he explains that inference by giving the analogy of the city which is surrounded and which the not even an animal the size of a cat could get into. So got quite a cute and memorable little image there. You can imagine this kind of little cat wandering around the walls of the city looking for a way of getting in. And what is that inference of the Dhamma which he understands, and which is really the heart of the sutta, that to become enlightened, you abandon the five hindrances, you develop, become established on the four satipatthanas, four establishments of mindfulness, and develop the seven factors of awakening. and to realize full enlightenment. So all the Buddhas of past, present, and future practice that same way. Again, quite interesting that what's described as being the path of practice here for the Buddha is exactly the same as the path of practice for all the students and all the disciples. Right? That is the way of practicing and developing meditation which the Buddha taught for everybody else to do. This is another distinction between early Buddhism and later Buddhism. Later Buddhism, there tended to be more of a distinction between the Buddha and the disciples, and so the Buddha was given one way of practice, the disciples another, and the way of practice of the Buddha, of course, was to develop what's called the baramis, the 10 qualities or the 6 qualities in the Mahayana, over many countless rebirths and past lives and so on and so on and so forth, until eventually he was able to realize awakening in this life. That's according to the traditions. According to early Buddhism, the Buddha became awakened. It's got nothing to do with past lives. It's got nothing to do with the baramis. It's got to do solely with, as it says here, abandoning the 5 hindrances, establishing the mind in the 4 satipatthanas, and developing the 7 factors of awakening. And this is another one of those teachings which is emphasized in different ways many, many, many times throughout the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. And the most common teaching the Buddha gives in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, again and again he says, you know, you develop sila, the mind which has sila, has ethics, will become, then develop samadhi and develop wisdom, and when the mind has all of those things, then it will become fully liberated from all defilements. And he says again and again, it's because of not understanding, not abandoning these defilements and so on. This is why both you and I have persisted in this round of samsara for so long. And so he's constantly drawing attention to the sameness of his own suffering, his own samsara, with that of the disciples, and the sameness of his way of practice to escape from samsara with the way of practice of the disciples. Yeah? This is something which is emphasized very, very strongly right throughout these texts. Again, this is one of the criteria which we use for assessing whether a text is likely to be early or late. If a text disagrees with the later tradition, then of course it's more likely to be early. It hasn't been adopted and altered. It would have been very easy to alter this text, to put in a mention of the baramis or something like that, and to acknowledge those things, but we don't find that here, nor do we find it anywhere at all within any of the early Buddhist texts. So, now this teaching on the 5 hindrances, Piyatam gives a list of them you have here. Where are they now? Okay, so that's on the first page of the Piyatam's notes. So the 5 hindrances, of course, sensual desire, karma, chanda, ill will, vyapada, sloth and torpor, tina, midha, restlessness and worry, uddhacha, kukuccha, and doubt, vichikicca. So you should all know those 5 hindrances by heart. Both, I'm sure you probably all know them by direct experience. But it's also good to know what they are, you know, to memorize the list of them. Just write, if you don't know these things, one of the things that I did when I was first started practicing Dhamma, you know, become interested in a particular list, just write it out in a list and stick it on your wall. Leave it there for a week or two, and then you'll remember it. Very easy. That's all you have to do. Yeah, if you think 5 hindrances, write that out, put it on the wall, and then a couple of weeks later, then put up another one, and then that's how you remember all those things. Very easy. And so that's very helpful, yeah, in your meditation. You know, this is a list. So the Buddha, the Nivarana, or hindrances, the Buddha talked, they're a form of the defilements, okay? And the Buddha talked about defilements in many different ways, yeah, the different aspects of them. This particular aspect of defilements are those things which are an obstruction to meditation, in particularly. So this is what we have to abandon to be able to bring our mind to samadhi. The way that they're defined here is that they are the corruptions of the mind, cittas upakilesa, and the weakeners of wisdom, okay, panya dubalikarana. So that means that, of course, the Buddha always said that when your mind is in samadhi, when the mind is free of the hindrances, when the mind is in jhana, then it can know and see things as they really are. So by abandoning the hindrances, then you can know and see things as they really are. So this is what gives wisdom that power. Yeah? So the hindrances are that which weaken the wisdom, stop you from being able to understand things as they really are. I won't go into detail about what each of those hindrances are, but just I'll just make a etymological note. Not many people are aware of this, but the word nivarana is from the root which is traced back, a very important word in the Rig Veda, so more than 1,000 years before the Buddha. The root is used there for vritra. And the root vritra is the name of the dragon or the serpent. Yeah? One of the most popular stories in the Rig Veda that's mentioned many, many times is the story of the slaying of the dragon. Yeah? And the dragon Vritra is slayed by the hero Indra with his thunderbolt. And so vritra means it's literally like a constrictor, like a boa constrictor, yeah, like a serpent. Yeah. And so it's that all the forces of darkness are symbolized by that. What's enveloping your mind, yeah, constricting your mind. Yeah, you think of that's, to me that's a very powerful image. Yeah, you think when your mind's obsessed with the five hindrances, it's like there's literally a constrictor, yeah, wrapped around your brain and squeezing, squeezing all the life out of your brain. And yeah, that's what the five. That's what the root. It's interesting, isn't it? That root. Why that word was chosen? Okay. So then, next one is the four satipatthanas. Of course, contemplation of the body, contemplation of feelings, contemplation of the mind, and contemplation of mind objects. And Piyatan gives the list of those according to the version found in the Pali Canon. Now, the version found in the Pali version of Satipatthana Sutta is certainly incorrect or a later development, and I'll come back to that in just a minute. And then developing the seven factors of awakening. Seven factors of awakening being, the first one being mindfulness itself, second one, investigation of Dhamma, Dhamma Vichaya, effort, Virya, Piti is, Pia translates it as zest. What does Bhikkhu Bodhi use? Rapture? No, he doesn't have it here. I think Bhikkhu Bodhi uses rapture. Tranquility is pasadhi, and samadhi, which Pia has concentration, and I think Ajahn Brahm quite rightly criticizes that translation and prefers to use stillness for samadhi, I think is a much better word. Most of those are fairly obvious. What the only one which perhaps needs some explanation is piti. And so piti is, I think, probably best translated as rapture. You know, in some of the evangelical Christian circles, they have this idea of the end of the world they call the rapture. Have you heard of that? And that's when everyone's going to get lifted up into the sky, right? So all of the good Christians who happen to belong to the right brand of Christianity get lifted up into sky, and all of the sinners, especially the Buddhists and other people, are going to happy stay behind. They actually made a video game of that. And you like the game was, you know, you had to see how many you can convert before you get lifted up, before the rapture would come. And so it's actually quite a good, like the idea of rapture is actually quite similar to that in meditation. Not the bit about leaving everyone behind, but the bit about floating up out of your body, because that's actually often what it feels like. Not always, but often. And that's what rapture is. Rapture is that sense of uplift. Yeah, Pia has zest for it. So it's almost this kind of zingy feel in meditation. Yeah, so it has this meditation at the one hand has this tranquility, which is very settling. Yeah, it's very solid. But then the rapture, the piti is just it's got like it's like the bubbles in the meditation, which lifts you up. I mean that when it's when it's developed, you know, when it's strong and has a strong tranquility, then it's not disturbing or active. But in the early stages, while it's still quite coarse, then the rapture can be quite strong, quite can shake your body. So this is the rapture as a factor of awakening. And notice how in these factors of awakening, the Bhojangas, very strong emphasis on samadhi and on that the development of emotional qualities in the mind. It's only the Dhamma Vicaya is like the wisdom aspect, and most of the other qualities are all the samadhi qualities. So these this grouping of the hindrances, four foundations, establishments of mindfulness, and the awakening factors, as a set of dhammas, are met with again and again and again. It's not just in this sutta that we meet these things together. We meet them countless times throughout, especially the Bhojanga Samyutta, the Satipatthana Samyutta, and many other places in the Pali Canon. So this grouping is used as a common summary of the path of practice according to Buddhism, as it is used here. And so they're very kind of closely related. Generally speaking, what does each one of them mean? You've probably heard many teachings on what Satipatthana is and so on and so forth. Basically, what Satipatthana means in the suttas is meditation. That's really probably the simplest way of putting it. Satipatthana means what you do when you go and sit down and meditate. You watch your breath coming in and out. That is Satipatthana, okay? And that leads to the awakening factors, which is the samadhi, yeah, or the rapture, the tranquility. This is what Ajahn Brahm talks about, the beautiful breath, the jhanas, and so on. And that is leading to because of your establishment of mindfulness on your breath. Okay. Now there's obviously more to it than that, but that's the simplest and most straightforward way of understanding what these things are. Your mind has five hindrances, right? You sit down to meditate. By doing that, you abandon the five hindrances and then lead to samadhi through the bhojangas, and then having completed that, then you see things as they really are. That's really what this set of dhammas is talking about. Now, I mentioned in passing a bit earlier that the dhammanupassana section, the contemplation of dhammas in the Pali version, is not correct. And I'll just should explain briefly what I mean by that. In here, in Pia's notes here, it gives the list of dhammas. And the translations that he gives here, contemplation of mind objects, he says the five hindrances, the five aggregates, the six sense bases, the seven factors of awakening, and the four noble truths. Now, there's a number of issues here. One problem, this is often called contemplation of mind objects, dhammanupassana, and the word dhamma sometimes means mind objects. The problem is that not all of those things are mind objects. It includes, for example, the six senses. Right? Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. These are not mind objects. They're objects of the other senses. So clearly, dhammas in that case can't mean mind objects. It must have another sense. Another problem is that this part of the Satipatthana Sutta is found in quite different forms in the different versions of the Satipatthana Sutta. And so I study this in a lot of detail in my book, History of Mindfulness. So here's a plug for my book. It's great. Get it and read it. And in there I show that you have one version in Pali, or actually you have three versions in Pali of that passage, all of which have some differences. You have one version from the Sarvastivadin, one version from the Chinese Ekotara Agama, three versions from various Abhidhamma texts, and another version from you don't have Prajnaparamita for that section, so just the Abhidhamma text. And each one of those has some differences, okay? But the interesting thing is if you lay all of those texts on top of one another, right, so to speak, and you say, well, what is common to all of those things, then the common ones are the five hindrances and the seven factors of awakening, okay? That's very interesting, because then that's that's very much like this teaching that we have actually here, because part of Satipatthana is the five hindrances and seven factors of awakening. It's unifying all of these teachings as found here and as found in many, many other places in the canon. What's also interesting, and what I noticed when I was doing this, is that in the Pali Abhidhamma version of Satipatthana, it only has those two factors, right? Dhammanupassana is only abandoning the hindrances and developing the seven factors of awakening. And this is, I think, the only place ever in the Abhidhamma where the Abhidhamma is simpler than what you find in the suttas. Yeah? Everywhere else, the Abhidhamma goes into a lot more detail, but this place, the Abhidhamma is simpler. It's quite interesting. And the other interesting detail is in the commentary to one of the passages that deals with this, it actually specifically mentions that the contemplation of Dhammas was the abandoning of the hindrances and the development of the four bhojangas. So even the commentary preserves a tradition that was what Dhammanupassana really was. Okay? So this is quite interesting because it shows that there are multiple lines of inference which lead to that same conclusion. Remember what we talked before about inference as a source of knowledge. It's never 100%, okay? But when we can have many different indications that point in the same way, any one of those indications might be wrong, right? But when they all point in the same direction and lead to the same conclusion, then we can be quite confident in the conclusion that we reach. So in this case, we reach the conclusion by the fact that those three teachings are found frequently together in the canon. We find it because it's common to all the different versions. We find it because it's in the simplest version of that teaching in the Abhidhamma. It's also specifically attested in the commentaries and so on. So multiple lines of reasoning all pointing to the conclusion that the original form of contemplation of Dhammas was simply the abandoning of the hindrances and developing of the seven factors of awakening. So this is the course of practice which is being laid out here, that Sariputta says not only the disciples are practicing, but the Sariputta is saying for the Buddhas to become awakened as well. So the awakening of the Buddhas follows the same path as that of the disciples, and obviously must be the same awakening. So there's no difference between the awakening of the Buddhas and that of the other disciples. And so that's also quite an interesting little detail, isn't it? That the Buddha sort of congratulates him and praises him and so on. You know, you might think that the Buddha would be a bit put out by saying, you know, well, is that all, right? You know, you're putting me on the same level as all my students, right? And, you know, but I'm better than you guys, right? That's what we tend to think of these days, but that's not how the Buddha thought, yeah? The Buddha was like, yes, you get it, exactly. That's exactly what the awakening is. It's nothing more than that. So this is, I think, why the Buddha was very enthusiastic about this. And so he said, you know, and with all of that taken into account, this is why, again, that ending has an even more pregnant meaning. You should frequently speak about this to the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis, the laymen and the laywomen, yeah, and anybody, any foolish people who have doubt about the Dhamma will have those doubts removed. So anyway, so I'm trying to follow that injunction here. The Buddha said you should teach about this frequently, so I'm trying to teach about it frequently. And okay, so I should open it up now for questions. I think we finish at 4:30, is that right? It depends. Okay, so roughly 4:30. I think we probably have some questions from elsewhere in the 10,000-fold world system. Excellent. Josh in the US. Okay. So Josh, hi Josh, where's the camera? Hi Josh. I've heard stories of people who become very quickly enlightened after listening to a teaching from the Buddha. Is it possible for enlightenment to occur without spending years cultivating the mind? So this is a very interesting question, and one which comes up a lot. And we see, especially in stories about the Buddha and so on, that Very frequently we find these mentions of people who are listening to a teaching, and during that teaching suddenly they become awakened. And it all seems a bit unfair, really, doesn't it? I mean, we're going to retreats and doing all this practice and stuff. Oh, come on. And so some people then think, well, you know, it's just easier to, instead of you know, doing retreats and things, I just make a determination. I'll be reborn in the future in the time of Maitreya Buddha, and then he can teach me, and then I'll be able to get enlightened then, yeah, make it much easier, right? But what are you going to do? You know, I can imagine that you do that, you know, and you get born in the time of Maitreya Buddha and you go and see him and he's so full of faith and he's sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And you go to see Maitreya and you bow down and it's so wonderful and you tell him, Bhante, for many countless past lives I've made the determination to be reborn now so that I can come and receive teachings from you. Please teach me so that I can be liberated from all suffering. And then Maitreya, he'd be in a difficult position because Maitreya, you know, Maitreya is like the one who has lots of metta, right? Yeah, so he's the one who has lots of metta. But it would be really hard for him to avoid getting pissed off when people come to him with that kind of thing, right? And he's there sitting there thinking, hang on, I've got to have lots of metta because I'm Maitreya. But why? All I can teach you is abandon the five hindrances, develop the four satipatthanas, develop the seven factors of awakening. That's how you get enlightened. You had that teaching already from Sakyamuni Buddha. Why didn't you practice it under Sakyamuni? Why do you come and hassle me now? So what's going on here? Why does it seem that, you know, in the past, and it seemed to be so easy? Was it maybe that people were, you know, really wiser in the past? And they're dumber now. I mean, one of the things is if you just read those stories, right, it sometimes gives you the impression that like everyone was so pure and wonderful and enlightened and so on in the past, right? But if you read the Vinaya, right, it's the story of the discipline for monks and nuns, you actually read about all the bad monks and the bad nuns. And if you just read those ones, you think actually people were a lot badder in those days than they are today, okay? And they did some outrageous things, okay? I mean, they're so outrageous that the scholars who translated them into English refused to translate them. Okay, they said this is not fit for anybody to read. Okay, you have to read Pali to read them. I'm not going to tell you what they are. So I don't think it's right to say that, you know, people on the whole were more pure or less pure now. I don't believe these things. I think people are pretty much the same wherever they are. We all, you know, have the similar kinds of problems and so on. And you see this many, many times in the suttas, people dealing with grief and they're dealing with attachment and they're dealing with confusion. And it's all the same issues that we see with people today. I mean, the way, the form that it appears is a bit different. But basically, people were pretty much the same. So I don't think that that's the explanation. It should go without saying that obviously one thing here is that just simply the charisma and the presence of the Buddha. Okay, fair enough. I think that's taken for granted. We know how important it is to have a great teacher, and we know how that's affected us in one way or another in our life, and how much more so that would be in the case of the Buddha, right, to have that inspiration. So yes, clearly that would be a factor. But I don't know if that really explains the whole thing. One thing to bear in mind is that those stories of people getting instant enlightenment happen mostly in the later texts and only very, very occasionally in the early texts. Okay, very rarely. There are some cases, but they're very rare. And they almost always happen in the framing narratives rather than in the teachings of the Buddha themselves. And this is something that Venerable Brahmali emphasized yesterday in the early Buddhism course, and we're going to keep on reminding you about this because it's absolutely essential for your understanding of the suttas to be able to distinguish between the framing narrative. Thus have I heard, at one occasion the Blessed One was staying in such and such and such and such. We already heard a bit earlier how one of the framing narratives for the Chunda Sutta, which puts the Buddha in Savatthi at that time, can't be reliable. and he must have been closer to Vaisali at the time. So this framing narratives many times are less reliable than the teachings, and very often we find that when we compare the different versions of the same sutta, that the framing narrative is different and the teachings are the same. Okay? You know, almost always we find this. Okay? So probably 80 or 90% of the teachings are the same. Probably more than 90% of the teachings are all the same when we compare different versions, but only maybe 50% of the framing narratives are the same. So some of them are similar, but a lot of them are not. And particularly these accounts of when people get enlightened when hearing the Dhamma talk, very often they differ from the different versions. So in the Pali version, the teaching is exactly the same, but at the end of the Pali version it'll say, and so-and-so became a stream enterer. And in the Chinese version it'll say, so-and-so took the three refuges. Or in the Pali version it'll say, so-and-so asked for the going forth and practiced and became an arahant, whereas in the Chinese version it doesn't say anything. And we find these variants again and again and again. So I don't think that we should take these accounts as being something that's so literally historically true. We should look rather to the purpose of the accounts. And the purpose, why are these things there? Are these stories there in order to discourage you from meditating? Right? Is the purpose of them to convince you that you are hopeless and why bother practicing because these guys got it so easy? Is that why these teachings are there? No, I don't think so. They're there to demonstrate and to inspire you with the powerful and the liberating quality of the Dhamma. That's what they're there for. They're there to show you that these things are not just abstract teachings and philosophies, but they're things which have a real effect in bringing liberation to people. Remember that the suttas, the discourses, are accounts of teachings. Okay? They're not, for the most part, they're not accounts of people's meditation experiences. Yeah? And usually, you know, it just says that so-and-so went off and practiced in meditation and then came back and got enlightened or something like that. But it doesn't tell you about their 10 years or 20 years or 30 years of struggling to get up in the morning and sitting there with itches and all the mosquitoes flying in and all of that stuff that it took them. Yeah, their records, the suttas are the records of the teachings and not the records of the meditation experiences. So I personally think that in most of those cases, you know, that either they're just later development, or that they're presented in a compressed or abbreviated form that is just a sort of part of that literary style. However, I don't want to kind of rule out the possibility of something like this happening. I also think that the mind is very wonderful. And human beings are kind of amazing, and that sometimes incredible things happen. And so why not? Why don't amazing things happen? I think amazing things do happen. And so I think it's quite likely that these things do happen from time to time. But that shouldn't be taken as sort of implying that sort of the fact that extraordinary things happen from time to time to extraordinary people doesn't affect the basic practice that the rest of us are going to be doing. Okay, yeah. 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 Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, yeah. So there's one or two accounts of the arahants who became committed suicide, and there's some discussion in the tradition about whether they were arahants before they used the knife, as the idiom is, or whether they used the knife and then became arahants. Yeah. So that is an interesting thing. Yeah. Okay. So another question from Dhirayupa. Hi, Dhirayupa. This is one of the supporters from Bangkok, and she's coming to Perth soon, so look forward to seeing you here soon. Is the sutta on future Buddhas, which include Arya Maitreya and Rahu Buddhas, reliable? Rahu Buddhas? Who's Rahu? Is he a Buddha in the future? I don't know that one. Rahu is the demon who swallows the sun. Anyway, Maitreya is a future Buddha. I'm particularly interested to know about Rahu Buddha, the particular fifth Buddha from Arya Maitreya. Look, I have to admit, Hiriyupa, that I am not familiar with the prediction about Rahu. I only know the immediate Buddha is Arya Maitreya, who's mentioned in one place in the Pali Canon. All of the other future Buddhas are not mentioned anywhere in the Pali Canon. And I'm not sure. I'd be interested to know where that tradition came from. I don't think it's a particularly early tradition. Anyway, there is one sutta that does mention Maitreya appearing in the future. That's the Mahapadana Sutta. That's the Chakravartisi Hinata Sutta. And in the Digha Nikaya, and that gives that the story of Maitreya appearing. And again, as I mentioned before, these things are clearly not meant to be in historical time. Okay, it's not an account of something that's happening next week on Balmoral Beach in Sydney. Yeah, yesterday we saw the amphitheatre on Balmoral Beach that was built to receive the coming Maitreya. And I think if you Google Maitreya now, you'll probably find quite a few teachers around the place who claim to be Maitreya, who's alive and well and teaching in the world today. But clearly, the way it's described in the early suttas was not meant to be in a historical period. It was, you know, it gives quite a lengthy and very interesting discussion of the basically you have to go through the apocalypse first, really, yeah, the entire disintegration of civilization. And it's rebuilding. So this is actually quite an interesting story. But if that is a genuine prophecy of the Buddha, then it certainly applies to something that's going to happen many tens or hundreds of thousands of years in the future, if not even much longer. Google will tell us everything. Yeah, that should really be the Buddhist epistemologist should have put that as the third means of knowledge: direct knowledge, inference, and Google, yeah, which of course supersedes the other ones. Yeah. So I'm not 100% sure. One of the things we do know from the suttas is that the Buddha rarely, if ever, made prophecies about the future. And there's hardly anywhere where the Buddha actually does this. And all of the cases, the very few cases where he does, are somewhat dubious or questionable in one way or another. The Buddha did make statements about the future, but normally the kinds of statements he made about the future were rational and conditional states about the future. He would say, these are the fears of the future. For example, a series of suttas, the Anagata Bhayani Sutras, mentioned by King Ashoka, and he'd talk about the particular dangers that might happen in the future. For example, he might say, in the future times, if the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen and laywomen neglect live without respect and honouring the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, without respect and honouring the training, without respect and honouring samadhi, then this will be a cause for the decline of Buddhism in the future. So that's one example, and there's quite a few examples of suttas like that, where the Buddha's not sort of making a particular prediction, this is going to happen on such and such a day, but he's pointing to cause and effect. And that's, of course, so much more characteristic of the Buddha's teaching, yeah? Cause and effect, and it's conditional. So the very fact that the Buddha is putting these things in a conditional way suggests that the future isn't locked in place. And I don't think there's anything about the Buddha's teaching that really suggests this kind of deterministic view of the future, that we can know what's going to happen in the future and make these kinds of predictions. So I'm a bit, I don't think there's anything problematic about the idea of future Buddhas in principle, but I'm a bit suspicious about this idea of this kind of specific prediction of Maitreya Buddha. It's not to say that it's not an authentic teaching. It is found in the Nikayas, but as I said, only found in one place, and in that place is clearly a legendary or mythological context. But anyway, Dhiriyupa, if you want to know more about Rahu Buddha, then you need to ask somebody else. But if you do find, I'd be interested to know if you do find any more information about those other Buddhas of the future. It sounds like quite an interesting topic. Okay, so any other questions before we wrap up? Yeah.
I mean, but similarly, if you don't understand it straight away or stir up by the imagery, you lost the whole game. What is this idea of cat, size of the cat? I mean, this
the size of the cat? Yeah. Well, cats are good at sneaking in and out of things. Right. A mouse can get in and out.
Another sutta is the cat and the mouse.
Why a cat? Well, I think it's just a realistic image. It's realistic that you could build something that's got that you can make that's going to keep a cat out. But you know, if you say it's probably not realistic to say you can keep the mice out. So it's just a realistic image. So maybe that was the building standards, building code at the time. You know, you have to build the wall good enough to keep the cats out.
Practice and then having faith in the Tathagata. I mean, I can't connect the.
Oh, you can't connect the simile with the thing.
Well, I think that if I can connect, I always find it's very interesting.
If you think about it, for example, you think about the cat outside the town as being an unenlightened person, and then getting into the city is like getting into enlightenment. So to be able to get into the city, you have to be able to get through past the gatekeeper. Yeah? So if you're outside, you have to get past the gatekeeper. So these things, abandoning the hindrances, developing the four establishments of mindfulness and developing the awakening factors, that's what you have to do to get past the gatekeeper. Yeah. Elsewhere, actually, the gatekeeper is said to be mindfulness itself. Yeah. So that's part of the kind of a sort of a system of imagery that you find in the suttas. So mindfulness is like the gatekeeper. But here, just generally doing all of those practices. So if you do that, then that's what lets you get into the city. You are the cat. Yeah, anyone who wants to get into the city. So anyone who's unenlightened and wants to get into the city is a case. City is enlightenment. Nibbana is the city. Does that make sense? Why has Nibbana got walls? Because it's hard to get into. Okay, any other questions? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, the five hindrances. I don't like that one very much.
Number one, sensual desire.
Yep. All right. Yep. Yep.
But would you include, say, the family in that? Would you call
that? Yeah, that's an interesting question. There's one sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya that actually talks about that specifically. And it goes through, like normally when it talks about samadhi, it just talks about the five hindrances and abandoning those and going to samadhi, right? But in this particular sutra, it goes into it in more detail and sort of breaks it down a little bit. And sort of after abandoning the coarser forms of the defilements and the hindrances, then all that's left is, and it gives a list of more kind of subtle ones, and one of those is the thoughts about your family. So that's clearly something which is more, more subtle, and it's not so obviously just greed, right? So if you're sitting there thinking about what you want to eat, or you're sitting thinking about sex, or you're thinking about something like that, then that's obviously just a distraction, right? So you could just let go of that, right? But the thinking about your family, then there's actually a genuine sense of love and care and so on. So it's not a purely wholesome or unwholesome emotion. Usually, you know, our emotional connection with our family has a mixture, both of kind of attachment and complex emotions, as well as the pure love and so on. So this is why it's a more subtle kind of thing. But even that still has to be abandoned before the mind goes into samadhi. Yeah. 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 But it doesn't mean, of course, that, you know, obviously when you come out of meditation, it will come back. right? It's only a temporary abandoning, yeah? But still, if you're sitting there, you know, worrying about, you know, children or something like that, then, well... that attachment, yeah. Yeah. Okay. A serious last question. All right, give me a serious last question.
It's a technical question. What is doubt or uncertainty? It looks like if you read the sutta, there is a difference in the two words. The doubts and uncertainty.
Oh, well, these are just translations of Pali words. Yeah, they're not really, you can't. Generally speaking, in Pali, most of the time you find that when they use different words for a similar idea, mostly they're just synonyms, and so you shouldn't try to read differences into them. Actually, they're just idiomatic uses of synonyms, and often just repeated for the sake of. Preserving the information, so that if you repeat the same word in different synonyms, then if you forget one of the words or put an extra one in, it doesn't change the meaning of the sentence.
So in this way, in this context, this is simony. I mean, it's nothing. But if you go through the Majjhima Nikaya or a few of the, I mean, I just do a bit. Some sutta is making a big drama of these two sequence, how to... Because, you see, in the fatal factors, the word doubt is very important because it just encompasses, you break away the doubt. But some sutta, they make a difference between the two and the sequence, how you go about it.
I can't think of anywhere where there's a difference. If you show me a specific passage that you're talking about,
okay,
but generally speaking, anyway, just to say generally speaking, that these words like perplexity, doubt, uncertainty, and so on are just meant as synonyms. Okay, so if you show me, there might be specific passages where there's, you know, more subtle nuance involved, but generally they're synonyms. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah. Yep. Sorry, could you repeat the phrase?
Piyatanta translation. I said, search in my fate. What numbers? It means that Sariputta have no more fate when he is an enlightened.
Oh, okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Evang Pasano. Oh, okay. Yeah. Thank you for that. I hadn't noticed that. What does Bhikkhu Bodhi have there? Bhikkhu Bodhi has such confidence in the Blessed One. And the Pali, actually I think Pia has misspelt the Pali there. He's given in his footnote 14, he says Passano. Actually I think it should be Passano, double single S and a double N. So I have such confidence. But that is a good point, that elsewhere it discusses this question of faith, and you know, somebody who knows and sees the truth, you don't have to rely on faith for that. Yeah. So, but there's two kind of nuances in the way that that's treated. In a sense, it doesn't mean that somebody who sees the truth, or somebody like Sariputta who has that great wisdom, doesn't mean that they don't have any faith in that kind of sense. What it means is that they don't have to rely on their faith for finding out what the truth is. Okay, so they don't have to go by faith. So if you, and in fact, that very, that is the reason why that they don't have to go by faith is because their faith has been confirmed. There's nothing mysterious about that. You just take an analogy about a map. Let's say I have a map that's going to take me from here to the Perth city, And, well, I have faith that this map is going to take me there. It looks like it's well drawn. It looks like it's authoritative. Yeah. So I have a certain faith that it's going to take me there. By the time you followed the map, it takes you to the city. You arrive at the city. Yeah. And then you say, well, do I have to rely on faith in this map anymore? Well, no, I don't have to rely on faith because I'm here. I know where the city is. Yeah. But at the same time, so if, on the one hand, if you want to say, I don't have any faith in the map because I know where it is, so I don't have to rely on my faith. But at the same time, you say, well, your faith has been confirmed. Yeah. So you say you have perfect faith in that map now because you know that it does, in fact, lead to the destination. Okay, so that's why we find those two nuances in some different passages. Yeah. Yeah, but that's an interesting point. Yeah. Okay. So if there's no more questions, let's finish up by paying respects to the Triple Gem.